The subject about which I should like to speak is the nature and function of the intelligentsia in a modern society. Now, the word intelligentsia, as like the concept, is of course of Russian origin and was invented somewhere in the middle 60s. It didn't mean simply educated persons. It certainly didn't mean merely intellectuals as such. That is to say, those who are interested in general ideas or interested in ideas because they are interesting, because they are exciting, because they are important, whether or not they are necessarily true or false, which I take to be the general meaning of the word intellectual. It arises out of the specific circumstances of Russian society, and although this may sound historical, I think it may throw some light if I say something about that. Russian society, as we know, in the 19th century, particularly in the early 19th century, was, to use a modern term, highly underdeveloped. It was a backward society. It consisted to a vast extent of a mass of illiterate, semi-starved peasants, a certain number of bureaucrats holding them down with various degrees of efficiency, and a very small class of persons who received sufficient education either to be bureaucrats or to form that minimum number of lawyers, doctors, land surveyors, and other functionaries of society without which even so backward a mass as the Russians could scarcely be expected to get on. In a society of this type, where you have a very oligarchical, not to say despotic, regime at the top, a church without any tradition of scholasticism or rational argument, plenty of saints and martyrs and persons who gave examples of holy living and marvelous mystical illumination, but none of that intellectual discipline that was present, for example, in the Church of Rome. In a society, in other words, where knowledge and learning were very scarce, the position of the small minority of persons who had access to the civilization of the West, who could read books in foreign languages, who had some sort of contact with a general intellectual currents of the time, is always somewhat unique. These people feel cut off from the vast mass of the people with whom they haven't very much direct contact. They feel foreigners in their own land. They feel what is nowadays called alienated. And those among them with sensitive consciences, who are tender-minded and tender-hearted, feel a certain natural obligation to help their brethren who are less happy or less advanced than themselves and are possessed by a strong moral desire to improve the lot. Both of their country at large, as a backward entity, despised and feared by the civilized countries of the West, which was certainly the case after 1815 in Europe, on the one hand, and the vast mass of ignorance, darkness, oppression, misery in their own country. These people gradually became a group of self-conscious writers and persons engaged in other intellectual occupations who simply felt that to speak in public at all, to write, to lecture, even to preach, itself imposed special moral obligations which didn't obtain quite so strongly in the case of other men. Let me try and explain this a little. If, for example, you lived in Paris in the 20s or 30s or 40s of the 19th century, there were a very great many ideas knocking about in general, a lot of ideologies, a lot of movements, all of which clashed with each other and created what is called a general climate of opinion. But no given ideology, no given set of concepts so dominated society as to create a genuinely fanatical following. If you have a country like Russia, cut off from the West as much by the great religious schism as by any other cause, into which very few ideas were allowed to penetrate, in which literacy was very low, any idea which came in from the West at all, provided it had some kind of initial attractiveness, fell upon rich soil and became something that those who possessed it believed with a degree of passion hardly imaginable in the West. If you have a large vacuum and a very fresh and very untutored population, eager for light and eager for improvement, then almost any idea, no matter how foolish, no matter how obsolete, will find some ready response. And this was certainly the position in Russia in the 1830s and 1840s. Hence this immense addiction to ideas, this immense addiction to doctrines, not merely as something of intellectual interest, not merely as something to while away an idle hour, but perhaps as some kind of source of salvation, as something which perhaps, if believed in and above all acted upon, might lead people to a better life, such as some of them fondly imagined was being led in the West. This is the origin of the phenomenon of which I speak. Now, let me make it clear that these people were pro-Westerners. They were pro-Westerners because they groaned under a yoke which in some way, indeed quite effectively, prevented them from obtaining that degree of minimum normal education which was becoming more and more open to the inhabitants of the West. Consequently, idealization of the West certainly occurred. This produced its own reaction in the form of nationalist, patriotic, chauvinistic tendencies of a Slavophile and other kinds. Nevertheless, it was a very powerful phenomenon, as happens in every backward country which believes that it is by means of its progressive ideas and by means of its advanced and growingly democratic education that other countries are able to attain to a degree of political, economic, and other forms of effectiveness and power denied to themselves. Consequently, as I say, there was idealization of the West. The people of whom I speak believed in reason. They believed in rationalism as such. They believed that only by the critical use of reason could the reign of superstition, prejudice, accumulated tradition, blind obedience, servility, ignorance, and all the things which flowed from them, poverty, squalor, injustice, inefficiency, chaos, only by these means could these fearful evils be cured. Moreover, they believed in modern science as the greatest vehicle of progress, of reason in our day. And above all, of course, they believed in human progress. They believed that men could themselves, by the critical use of reason, improve their lot, and that appeals to non-rational sources of aid, whether religious or intuitive or even to some degree aesthetic, which they were under the impression, certain Western thinkers, certainly after the failure of the French Revolution, urged upon others, that these were not true sources either of enlightenment or of progress. Therefore, one has to be quite clear, the Russian intelligentsia, because there were so few, and because they felt a sense of moral responsibility for their brothers, felt a certain sense of solidarity as a kind of dedicated order of people upon whom, because they alone were educated amid a mass of the ignorant and the pathetic, that they had a duty to lift these people. And because there were few, they were bound by a sense of common loyalty and common solidarity, felt a natural sense of kinship, and as it were called out to each other in the darkness, and felt to themselves to be citizens of a state within the state, soldiers in an army dedicated to progress, surrounded on all sides by reaction and by hostility to reason and to the natural ideals of mankind. This is the kind of phenomenon which occurs in what might be called backward reactionary states dominated by an inefficient form of government and an ignorant and oppressive church. For example, there could be said to have been intelligentsia in Spain in the 19th century. perhaps in certain countries of Latin America. It didn't happen to nearly such an extent, let us say, in France, where, of course, there were great battles between ideas, but there were ideas on both sides. There were progressive ideas and reactionary ideas. There were clerical ideas and anti-clerical ideas. And therefore, the notion of the intelligentsia did not spring up as such. Still less was this the case in England. I should like to make this a little clearer. Members of the intelligentsia in Russia had to be rationalists. They had to believe in the West. They had to believe in science. They had to believe in the power of scientific enlightenment. They had to feel themselves to be surrounded by an outer darkness against which they were fighting and into which they were trying to inject some kind of light. They had to believe in human progress. And only if they believed in all these things, and only if they were filled with a sense of human concern for their brothers, only if they felt that anyone so privileged as they to have the means of expressing themselves articulately in public, thereby acquired an obligation to tell the truth, because those who stand on public platforms and speak are obliged to tell the truth as those who do not are not, whether they write novels, whether they write poetry, whether they engage in all kinds of forms of even of imaginative literature. The mere fact of addressing a public itself imposes a kind of special duty to tell the truth. Only those who believed in the mission, in other words, of the educated, in the mission of those who spoke in public, in the mission of those who were capable of influencing their fellows, only these were members of the intelligentsia. If you were a French writer, or even if you were an English writer, you might very well take the view that, after all, you were a purveyor like any other kind of purveyor. This would certainly be the attitude of those, for example, French writers who believed in arts for art's sake, or those essayists who believed themselves simply to write prose which was as lucid and as beautiful as they could make it, and who saw themselves simply as craftsmen, simply as persons who produced an object and wished to be judged by that object alone. If a man makes a silver box, provided the silver box is beautiful, that is all that can be expected of him. This point of view was rejected with ferocity by the Russians of whom I speak. The idea that a man plays roles, that if he's a goldsmith, you judge him qua goldsmith, in the part of a goldsmith, and that his family life has nothing to do with it. If he's a writer, you simply judge him by the merit of his novel or the merit of his poem, and that his private life has no relation to it. These things were rejected by the Russians because they believed that man was one, that any form of compartmentalization was a maiming of human beings, an artificial view of them, that a man who spoke in public said what was within him with the whole of his nature, and that the idea that he was speaking for certain narrow purposes alone, say to give pleasure, say to make money, say to satisfy a certain market, or even to amuse himself, or even to amuse others, this was in some sense manipulating the public, using them as means and not as ends, not being candid with them, not being sincere with them, not behaving as a human being among human beings. This fundamental point of difference is what distinguishes the general attitude both of Russian critics and of Russian writers, with certain exceptions in the 19th century, from a good many writers in the West. And this is central to this particular concept, to the concept of the intelligentsia. I don't mean to say that all important Russian writers belong to it. On the contrary, those who were born in the 18th century, people like Pushkin and his contemporaries, didn't, of course. They were elegant poets, sometimes of genius, sometimes not, like poets of every other country. Writers like Gogol and Tolstoy rejected the very idea of the intelligentsia because their view of human beings was quite different. They did not believe in reason, they did not believe in science, they did not believe in the West, and they looked with contempt upon those deluded imitators of the West who did not understand the inner life of man and were in some way apt to mistake what a merely superficial aspects of human life or material aspects of human life, after which the West had obviously very mistakenly gone, to mistake these things for the inner life of man, which had nothing to do with progress, with science, with reason, or with any of these minor human virtues by which humanity, true humanity, had never lived. This is to some extent true even of writers like Chekhov, even of writers like Gorky. Turgenev was betwixt and between. Sometimes he adhered to one side, sometimes to the other. He oscillated comfortably between a pro and anti-intelligentsia point of view. The real members of the intelligentsia were the political pamphleteers, were the civically minded poets, were the forerunners of the Russian Revolution, mainly journalists and political thinkers, who quite consciously used literature, sometimes very poor examples of it, as vehicles for social protest. The protest of the writers of whom I speak, of Dostoevsky, of Tolstoy, of Gogol, was of quite a different order. Their conception of human being was incompatible with the notion that the business of man is to be enlightened, to be rational, to be progressive, to be scientific, and that only in these things will ultimate salvation come. Only from these things will ultimate salvation come. Now, given that this is the central concept of the intelligentsia, let me now move to the West. Professor Northrop Frye, in a very sharp and interesting piece recently published on the morality, in a book of essays devoted, or lectures devoted to the morality of scholarship, makes an interesting and important point when he says that, broadly speaking, the tendency of Western thinkers has been to take science as the paradigm. And because science is objective, because science is factual, because science means freedom from personal or subjective influences, freedom from value judgments above all, there has been a tendency for intellectuals to prize and sometimes to overprize objectivity. Prize and overprize scientific method to the degree at which such objectivity becomes detachment, detachment of the kind which is normally ascribed to those who are engaged in the natural sciences. Detachment which makes, say, an atomic physicist shrug off inquiries about his social responsibility with a certain degree of irritation. He's simply engaged on the discovery of the truth. He's engaged on research. The application and consequences of his discoveries are no more his business than that of any other citizen of the state, however it is governed, which makes people engaged in psychological or physiological research equally reluctant to admit their responsibility because their experiments may lead to all kinds of astonishing transformations of human beings and may give to certain individuals vast and dangerous powers of conditioning people, of altering people's character, of altering their responses. This is called the detachment or objectivity of science, and Frye thinks that this can go too far, that in fact scientists engaged upon this kind of work, which has obvious social implications, cannot simply shrug off or opt out of responsibility in these matters, although he doesn't tell us how much responsibility these persons bear or what they should, if so, what they should do about it. For example, whether they should refuse certain forms of research because they anticipate dangerous consequences if wicked men are allowed to make use of their discoveries. And he also says that the kind of social concern which I attributed to the Russian intelligentsia, the kind of social concern about the human consequences of ideas, or the human significance of what a man says when he speaks in public, the notion that even if you are a frivolous poet, even if you are a professional philologist or critic, your personality is bound to come out in your words whether you mean it or not, and therefore you must accept responsibility for what you say, even if ostensibly what you are saying is a purely professional, purely rather narrow, rather detached kind of statement, that this concern can also go too far. This social concern can easily, in moments of crisis, become a kind of hysteria, as it does in the case of those who seek to protect our societies against real or imaginary subversion. And this is what is responsible for all kinds of censorships, all kinds of intellectual crusades, all kinds of attempt to organize writers or artists or other persons engaged in what might be called professions concerned with communication with other human beings, particularly intellectual communication, to organize these people to defend our country, whether against communism or against fascism or against religion or for religion, or whatever it may be, that in fact the organization, over-organization of these people can itself become a danger, that the attempt to cling to some existing order which you may think very good, and therefore to rationalize your defense of this order as some kind of intellectual duty, if I don't misinterpret Fry, itself becomes the opposite danger, itself becomes a form of intolerance and the suppression of freedom of speech and the suppression of reason. Between these two poles, the unfortunate dealers in ideas and the unfortunate dealers in other forms of human communication, art, thought of whatever kind, attitudes to life, what is generally called the field of ideology, are compelled to live and find some kind of equilibrium for themselves. Broadly speaking, the idea of intelligentsia is the idea of a permanent opposition to a status quo which is regarded as in permanent danger of becoming ossified, in permanent danger of becoming a block to human thought, a block to human communication, a narrowing of human beings, and a crushing of enterprise and of freedom, both of development and of communication. This is the historic role of intelligentsia. It doesn't just mean intellectuals as such, and it doesn't just mean artists as such, and it certainly doesn't mean educated persons as such. The educated can be reactionary, just as the uneducated can. So can intellectuals, so can artists. We know all this very well in our day. This happens on both sides of the Iron Curtain to the same melancholy extent. Nor does it mean sheer opposition as such. Persons who protest against CND, CND marchers, people who protest, on the contrary, against the uses of atomic energy for destructive purposes, or persons who protest against the Vietnam War. No matter how sympathetic one may feel to their moral position, no matter how well one may think of them as human beings, and whether one thinks their point of view correct or not, are not simply because they're protesting against the behavior of their governments or the general behavior of their society, members of the intelligentsia as such, because these persons do not necessarily believe in the power of reason. They don't necessarily believe in the power of science. They don't necessarily believe in the power of, in the inevitability, or at any rate, even the desirability of human progress. Sheer protest, whether justified or unjustified, even organized protest, against what is regarded as immoral conduct by a government or by society, does not qualify you to be a member of intelligentsia as such. What does do so is this combination of belief in reason, belief in progress, hatred of all forms of irrational conduct, together with a profound moral concern for society. And these phenomena are much more likely to occur, obviously, these kind of movements are much more likely to arise in countries where the opposition is deepest and blackest, and least likely to arise in loose, democratic, relatively open societies, where the sort of persons who might be made indignant in the more reactionary societies are apt to, because of the freer atmosphere which surrounds them, to devote their energies to ordinary pursuits, to being a doctor, to being a lawyer, to being a professor of literature, to being, whatever it may be, a civil servant, without an oppressive sense that in doing so, one is somehow failing one's duty, that in not taking part in some kind of collective civic indignation or some organized protest or resistance to evil tendencies, one is somehow abandoning one's post. This really only happens in societies which are relatively oppressive. And whether England is such or not is not something on which I wish to pronounce. Broadly speaking, I should have thought one could easily exaggerate if one supposed that in England, of all countries, there is a particular role for this kind of ferocious, this kind of unsurrendering, this kind of well-organized, this kind of revolutionary intelligentsia. But that is only, perhaps, my private subjective point of view. Others may well think quite differently. The point I merely wish to bring out is what the historic role of intelligentsia is. And if you then ask, what about critical thought about our lives and about our pursuits. Let me explain that to the old-fashioned member of the intelligentsia, say a Russian member of it in the 19th or 20th century, or even a French member of it, so far as there was a French intelligentsia, and there was something rather more analogous to the Russian in France because of the existence of what they regarded as the dark factors of, for example, clericalism or other forms of anti-rationalism. To such persons, the very notion of a large class of persons involved in intellectual pursuits, professors, doctors, engineers, experts of one kind or another, writers, who in other respects belonged to society in a perfectly normal fashion, who lived the ordinary lives of the middle classes to which they belonged, who played golf or played cricket, or behaved in every other respect as ordinary members of what these people would regard as a Philistine establishment, would have been absolutely horrifying. If a man is a professor, or was a professor, say in late 19th or early 20th century Russia, then surely the mere fact of his involvement with reason, involvement with ideas, must make him a bitter and implacable opponent of the irrational circumstances and regime in which he lives. And if he fails to do that, then he has sold out. Then he is a traitor or a coward or a ninny of some kind. This is true even, I should say, of contemporary Italians and Frenchmen, where the mere fact of a historically organized church as a permanent factor in social and political life creates an anti-clerical tradition, which means that persons engaged in these, as might be said, intellectual or at any rate highbrow professions, so to speak, are automatically expected not merely to be critical in a mild way, but to have a particular degree of social concern and, when necessary, social indignation against the immorality and the crimes of the state, be it a foreign war or some other form of obvious social injustice. This becomes progressively less obvious as you move from the south to the north or the east to the west. In countries like England, like Scandinavia, for example, this is less noticeable. And it is less noticeable because the enemy is not quite so evident. Because there isn't some great historic enemy like the monarchy or the church or some other agency which is regarded as a powerful destroyer of reason, of science, of progress, of democracy. And England, it seems to me, is somewhere betwixt and between. No doubt it is the duty of those who deal in ideas to be rational, to be critical, and to suit the action to the word, to live integrated lives, not to allow their thought to linger in one compartment and their action in another, not to say to themselves that to be a professor or to be an artist is a profession like that of a blacksmith or a chartered accountant, which does not impose upon them special social responsibilities. Nevertheless, mere awareness of one's intellectual responsibilities doesn't constitute one into a permanently subversive, permanently oppositional, permanently, a force permanently ill at ease, systematically opposed to the status quo, to whatever goes on, because the assumption is that those who have established the status quo and those who are comfortable in it and those whose lives it penetrates are automatically enemies of progress, enemies of science, enemies of reason, and ultimately enemies of mankind. And that is why, broadly speaking, one cannot really speak of an English intelligentsia. One can speak of English intellectuals. One can speak of persons who are educated and persons who are not. One can talk about the duties of literacy. But it's quite clear that if you said to someone who was literate, someone who was educated, someone who was at home with ideas, that for him not to be subversive, for him not to be revolutionary, was some kind of moral abandonment of his social post, some kind of awful, cowardly, ideological self-delusion. If you said this to him, he would quite properly answer that this was only true on certain assumptions. for example, say, on Marxist assumptions where one must belong to either one class or another in a condition of class warfare, either to the class which is fighting or to the class which is fighting back, either the class which is progressive or to the class which needs to be destroyed. But if you don't accept these assumptions, then these obligations don't necessarily follow. It is one thing to have an obligation to be rational, to be critical, to be, so to speak, a stirrer of ideas, a stimulator of controversy, an upholder of reason, and above all, a man anxious to apply rational criteria to social action. It is another thing automatically to assume that since there are very few such persons and they live desperate lives, one automatically belongs to a kind of army, oppositional army, which all its life will seek to blow up the evil and wicked system which blocks the progress of mankind. These two things are not identical. In Russia, they were for the particular historical circumstances which I have described. Something of the sort was also true in certain other countries, certainly in countries like Spain, perhaps later in the Balkans, perhaps later still in the Middle East, and it may be in Asia and Africa today. But at the risk of complacency, I have to say that the direct application of this to the conditions of more inefficient, looser, perhaps drearier, but essentially less oppressive forms of democratic government is a kind of automatic transfer which needs to be looked into carefully case by case before any validity for it can be established. America is the country which is at the present moment most possessed by discussion and doubts on this particular subject. It is in a peculiar position. There, perhaps, there are huge, dark forces which have to be resisted in a sense in which perhaps because of its very progress, perhaps because of its very exhaustion, perhaps because of its very growing unimportance, are no longer quite so perceptible in England and the countries of the European Northwest. I wish to draw no conclusion from this at all, only to say that not every form of critical responsibility, not every form of social concern, not every form of a society, the members of which actively participate in the common life of a community, of a society, are necessarily to be either classified as or as intelligentsia, or if there is no such body, are necessarily to be sympathized with on this account. Conditions differ, and our condition in this respect differs very widely, whether for better or for worse, from the countries in which this particular phenomenon took its rise.